most Americans, the president believes that we cannot allow a mere allegation, in this case one from many years ago, to destroy a person's life. However, the president also believes that if these allegations are true, Judge Moore will do the right thing and step aside.
Pretty easy to feel good after this past election in Alabama. Who would have thought that a Democrat would come to prominence in Alabama, fill a seat in Alabama, and to fill Jeff Sessions' old seat? Nevertheless, don't forget about that. That seat belonged to Sessions, who had to give it up so he could go work for the Trump administration. It was then filled by the governor of Alabama, who put Luther Strange in there, but Luther Strange had to defend the seat. He had to run for the seat. So he runs for the seat in a primary and gets taken down by Roy Moore. And you know the rest of the story. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 232. My name is Melvin, and I want to thank you so much for being here. So we can't help but feel good. Look what we did in Alabama, but let's bring ourselves down just a little bit, shall we? We won, but barely. 1.5%. It's a razor-thin margin. But it's the kind of margin that if a Republican won, he would be claiming all kinds of superpowers. I got 100% of the vote. Trump lost by 3 million and claims that he has a mandate. We won by 1.5%. And we ran against a child molester. Excuse me. An accused child molester. And it was 1.5%. So what should be our takeaways from Alabama? First of all, the DNC was on the ground this time. And they were on the ground in a lot of counties that they didn't put any resources into. So even though it was a child molester that the Republicans had ran, he still came pretty close to winning, I thought, right up until the election. I mean, right up until I got the news at 7:30 local time, I thought that Roy Moore was just going to run away with this thing. And at that point, he had been holding on to it for ever since the polls closed. And then when I found out that Doug Jones won, I said, all right, it's very exciting, but what can we learn from this? So 91% of Republicans voted for him. So dig this. If you live in Alabama, you cast a ballot for him, my God, are you having a good couple of years. Because last year, you cast a ballot for a white supremacist, somebody who is sympathetic to the Nazis. And then this year, you cast a ballot for an accused child molester. Now, if you're casting ballots for Nazis and child molesters, you have to think, just even if to yourself, for just a minute, what the bloody hell am I doing? How great are my ideas? Are my ideas worth defending if I have to vote for Nazis and child molesters? I shouldn't have to say this out loud. So, another takeaway, because the DNC was on the ground, they got the black vote out. 98% of African Americans voted for Doug Jones. And so we should have had a larger margin, right? There's a fair amount of African Americans in Alabama. But Alabama did something a couple of years ago. As soon as the Supreme Court overturned voting rights, Alabama immediately put into place a voter ID law. Then in all of the majority black counties, they decided to close all of the DMVs, well, not all of the DMVs, but most of the DMVs, and especially DMVs that were on a bus line. So the DMVs that were left in Alabama in those majority black counties had very limited hours. Some of them were only open one day a week, and almost none of them were on a bus line, because that's where you need to get your ID. So Alabama did its damnedest to keep African Americans away. We had an issue during the primary where Bernie Sanders wasn't reaching out to African Americans enough. And I had a rally at my house. And I had, of all the people that were there, I had one African-American woman, if I'm not mistaken. And I asked her, hey, what has Bernie got to do? I gave a speech at my Bernie rally, and I let her get up and give a speech too, because she talked with us, and her name was Lydia, if I'm not mistaken. She talked with us about what Bernie needs to do, what the Democratic Party needs to do, and what we as supporters need to do in order to get more African Americans out to vote. And I thought that it was fairly enlightening. It's one of those things that that was a good takeaway from 2016 for me. There were a lot of counties that Democrats didn't go into, that Hillary Clinton didn't go into, and that, even sadly, Bernie Sanders did not go into. Bernie admitted it. Admitted he had a bit of a blind spot during that election.
When you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be poor. You don't know what it's like to be hassled when you walk down the street or you get dragged out of a car. And I believe that as a nation in the year 2016, we must be firm in making it clear we will end institutional racism and reform a broken criminal justice system.
Hillary Clinton reached out to African Americans a little bit, but certainly not as much as she could have. The numbers that turned out in Alabama this past Tuesday night far surpassed even what turned out during the general election last year. So the work on the ground was good. But we've got two problems still, okay? We can win in these red places, but it might not be by much. So the margin for error is pretty small. We've got to fight against voter ID. That's a big one. Because, yeah, the African-American vote turned out and it made a difference, but states like Alabama, a lot of red states, are doing their best to make sure that these folks do not have a vote, do not have a voice in the democratic process. We cannot be afraid to get on the ground in these places that are considered red counties. And we can have a lot more elections like this. An election like the blowout that we had a couple of weeks ago, and then, of course, like the election that we just had in Alabama. We can have more of those. And honestly, we've got the wind at our back. Another issue, and I hate to say this because it unfortunately seems to be bipartisan, with a big qualifier, obviously. And that is the woman issue. Both Democratic and Republican lawmakers have been busted in recent months, have had to step down in office. One guy even committed suicide. It's getting bad. And this type of thing seems to affect these elections pretty good. I think the stuff that Roy Moore did as a pedophile and as a guy who tried to take advantage of women, that counted against him. We're not going to have those kinds of people all the time, but we will have people that will be mentioned in the same sentence as the Me Too movement. But obviously the big difference here is when it comes to Democrats, they're pretty good at admitting that, yeah, I did that and I should not have. Whereas the Republicans just deny, 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 deny. And sometimes that denial pays off for them, at least in the short run. I give you, and these are the ladies that came out after he was accused, I give you ladies for Roy Moore.
Women are coming forward in Alabama to support Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who is facing allegations of sexual misconduct.
I truly believe the truth will come out and will show that Judge Moore is being falsely accused, just like Joseph in the Bible.
One woman said it's a case of he said, she said that cannot be proven.
If these accusers are not telling the truth, and if Roy Moore is defeated, Alabama is the victim.
Just like Joseph in the Bible. And we're going to talk about that because that seems to be the driving factor. There seems to be two driving factors here when it comes to a crowd, especially a female crowd. So men voted for Roy Moore. White men over 70%. White women voted for Roy Moore over 60%. So he still got a majority of white people even after he admitted what he did. Two things here. The excuse that was given to us about why Roy Moore did this stuff and why it was A-okay was because that's just the way things were back then. Those were the good old days, and that's the way we got down. Of course, the other thing is that he didn't mean anything by it. You know, you should be flattered. It's okay. And you know what? These women are probably lying anyway. I give you Man on the Street. This is from MSNBC. And this voter's name, who's torn as to what to do, this voter's name is Charlotte.
One quick question from the anchor. We had discussed this earlier. What is your belief in the allegations that have come forward against Roy Moore? You spoke earlier that you were kind of skeptical about those.
Yes. Well, I have to believe that most of it is a lie. I really think there could be some truth, but Roy Moore has denied all of it. I would like for him to speak more about it and tell us, and if he's guilty of some of what is alleged that he has done, then he certainly was wrong and should never have happened. However, he still denies it. And it was almost 40 years ago. Now, I do believe people change. And I have to believe the last 40 years I've followed his career, and I do believe that he has been a good, in many ways. He hasn't been the leader a lot of people in this state want, but I think he stands by his Christian principles, by and large. And so if he's guilty, then, you know, God will judge him.
Christian! It's okay. We're praying for him. It's all right. He's a good Christian. This is the thing that's the most frustrating to me, because you can be absolutely blinded by this stuff. And there's nothing wrong with being a Christian. But if you're willing to vote for an accused pedophile just because you believe in their heart, they're a good Christian. And this was a big, big, big part of that election. And I can't put myself in the mindset of these folks, but I want to tell you what we're up against when it comes to this. So in Pensacola, Florida, at a rally a couple weeks ago, Senator Doug Broxson was speaking in front of a bunch of Donald Trump supporters. Of course, Donald Trump was out stumping, but he gave a speech for Roy Moore, but he gave it next door in Florida. So just about 100 miles away. He didn't want to be in Alabama, but he wanted to get out and support Roy Moore. And Senator Doug Broxson got up and decided to speak to the crowd. And he decided to get them very, very excited about the coming end times. Quoting here, so as you know, Donald Trump decided to move our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and recognize Jerusalem as the capital. And Trump supporters believe that he did so to usher in the end times. This is true. So speaking before the crowd, Doug Broxson said, and I quote, "Now, I don't know about you, but when I heard about Jerusalem, when the King of Kings, where our soon coming king is coming back to Jerusalem, it is because President Trump declared Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel." And then the crowd cheers. Theological scholar Dana Butler Bass wrote a Twitter thread explaining the link between the recognition of Jerusalem, evangelical Christians, and the apocalypse. This is important because rebuilding the temple is the event that will spark the events in the book of Revelation for the end times. When I was growing up, my mom used to talk with me about Revelation all the time, so I'm fairly well versed in this. According to Bass, Trump listens to the council of evangelical advisors who take such end times prophecies quite literally. Of all the possible theological dog whistles to his evangelical base, this is the biggest, she continued. Trump is reminding them that he's carrying out God's will to these last days. They've been waiting for this. They've been praying for this. They want war in the Middle East. And now, by announcing that he's going to move our embassy, it's already started a war in the Middle East. The Battle of Armageddon, at which time Jesus Christ will return to the earth and vanquish all of God's enemies, meaning liberals, women, presumably. She warned that for some evangelicals, this is what is known as a climax of history. Remember those three words, climax of history. You're going to hear it a lot in evangelical circles as Trump does more and more of those things to help bring about the end times. Sorry, I just wanted to put a oomph. It's very exciting. It's the end times. And Trump is taking them there to the promised judgment, to their sure victory. The righteous will be ushered to heaven. The reprobate will be banished to hellfire. And people believe this. They really believe this. They've given their lives to these ideas. They sing about them in church, evangelize others, teach them in Sunday schools. And on that morning, the news of Jerusalem, those people were ecstatic. This is the fulfillment of a biblical prophecy. And Donald Trump is not only acting on a campaign promise, but he is enacting a theological one. So the United Church of God names the seven prophecies that foretell the second coming of Christ. Okay, count them off. Number one, the human race would have the ability to exterminate itself. That's nuclear weapons. That's number one. A Jewish homeland had to be reestablished in the Middle East. Trump has now proclaimed Jerusalem as the capital. That's number two. There must be two leaders, the end time king of the north and the end time king of the south. Okay, we don't necessarily have a fulfillment for that one yet, but it's coming. An end time union. This is what they see the European Union as. Okay, the end time rise and fall of Israel and Judah. So that's another one that's got to be fulfilled. But hold on, the last two, number six and seven, are, according to these Christians, already fulfilled. The gospel will be preached in all the world. The internet, YouTube, it all those mediums allow for that to happen. And of course, instant worldwide communications of God's final witnesses. And of course, they communicate over the internet. And Roy Moore is a typical Republican in which he doesn't want to do good. He wants to be picked. He wants to be put in there because he wants to do awful things. In Alabama, he was kicked off of the bench twice. He gets in trouble a lot. And his proudest moments in government were when he gummed things up, when he screwed things up, you know, when he broke things and then said, aha, you are not God and you can do nothing on God's planet. That's the stuff he liked to do. And this is why they worked so hard to bring him down, whether it was Project Veritas or whoever created this robocall, which somebody caught on an answer machine and released to the media. But somebody, because the Washington Post had all these stories on Roy Moore, but somebody from the Washington Post, someone identifying themselves as being from the Washington Post, was calling with this robocall, saying, hey, would you like to accuse Roy Moore? We'll give you some money.
Hi, this is Lenny Bernstein. I'm a reporter for the Washington Post. I'm calling to find out if anyone at this address is a female between the ages of 54 to 57 years old, willing to make damaging remarks about candidate Roy Moore for a reward of between $5,000 to $7,000. We will not be fully investigating these claims. However, we will need a written report. I can be reached by email, lbernstein@washingtonpost.com. Thank you.
It's pretty dirty, and it's actually quite anti-Semitic. He's got this nasally voice. His name is Lenny Bernstein. He didn't mention matzo ball soup or whatever the hell it's called. But God dang it, it sure sounded like he wanted to. So, A, people hearing this go, oh, it's fake. There's the Washington Post asking for fake people, which wouldn't be a good idea if that is what they were doing, which they weren't. Obviously, too many of the claims against him were true. But it still helped cement that evangelical base to get them to do what the Republican Party wanted them to do. And Frank Luntz had a focus group, and he wanted to talk to Roy Moore supporters and ask him, hey, you know, do you still support him? what kind of thinking leads you to still support him? And a lot of the things that his supporters said was pretty amazing, but this one especially caught my ear.
He could be forgiven for. I don't think he raped.
And let's be real. It was a different world. 40 years ago in Alabama, people could get married at 13 and 14 years old. My grandmother at 13 was married. At 15, had two children and a husband and a job. If Roy Moore was guilty, if he was at the mall hitting on this 14-year-old, 40 years ago in Alabama, there's a lot of mamas and daddies that'd be thrilled that their 14-year-old was getting hit on by a district attorney.
If you find yourself defending Nazis, calling them good people, if you find yourself defending a pedophile, and this is the same party that screamed their guts out and still do to this day about how Bill Clinton is a pervert and his wife is an enabler, but a pedophile, as long as it's a Republican, that's A-OK. So Christianity Today, post-loss, the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today posted an editorial, quoting him from Ross Story, that concludes that Christian faith was the clear loser in the Alabama special election. Quote, no matter the outcome of today's special election in Alabama for a coveted U.S. Senate seat, there is already one loser, and that is the Christian faith. Whether it when it comes to either matters of life and death or personal commitments of the human heart, no one will ever believe a word we say, perhaps for a generation, the editorial explained. Christianity's integrity is severely tarnished. The editorial noted that the Alabama special election put an exclamation point on a problem that has been festering for a year and a half. Ever since a core of strident conservative Christians began to cheer for Donald Trump without qualification, and a chorus of other believers decried that support as immoral. The Christian leaders who have excused, ignored, or justified his unscrupulous behavior and indecent rhetoric have only given credence to their critics who accuse them of hypocrisy. When a public Christian is accused of some immorality, the honorable and moral thing to do has been to take a leave of absence until the matter is settled. This is precisely what Moore, who sees himself as godly and a moral candidate, refused to do. The republicanism of some evangelical Christians harms the gospel of Jesus. When combative conservative Christians refuse to suffer patiently in the public square, retaliate when insults are hurled at them, and do not refrain from the appearance of evil, they sabotage not only their political cause, but the cause they care about the most, the gospel of Jesus Christ. That is how the editorial concluded. So if it isn't Christianity that's in their hearts, that is at the core of what they're doing right now, what is? And in an effort, in the final days of the election, to not seem anti-Semitic, because they did some pretty anti-Semitic things, Kayla Moore, bless her heart, decided to hit the stage with this.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew. We had very close friends that are Jewish and rabbis, and we also fellowship with them.
When Ted Kennedy died, shortly after Obama was elected, that opened up a seat in the Senate. That seat was not defended all that well by the Democrats, and Scott Brown ended up in that seat, a Republican. And Mitch McConnell said, hey, we should not have any more votes in the U.S. Senate until Scott Brown is seated. Not the person holding the seat, but the person that was duly elected by the American people is in that seat. So, what do you think his stance is going to be now that they've got this gigantic tax bill coming up, and Luther Strange is leaving that Senate seat and a Democrat is coming in? Do you think that Mitch McConnell is going to be as consistent about that particular point?
Sunday is Christmas Eve. The following Monday, Christmas Day, that is when the president has promised that he's going to send this tax bill, sign this tax bill. He has said it's going to be a Christmas present for the American people. Right now, that timeline seems to be holding for Republicans in Congress. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said this morning that because of the results in Alabama, Republicans should hold off. They should wait until Jones is able to be seated before this vote is held. That is, of course, what Mitch McConnell called for when Scott Brown was elected in Massachusetts in a scenario that some are comparing to what happened in Alabama last night. But so far, there's no indication that McConnell is going to slow down this process. And it looks like this is something, a massive rewrite of our tax code. It's going to affect every American business, every American family, likely to be done before Christmas.
Kristen Gillibrand has not been quiet about her criticism of this particular president. The fact that he himself is a sexual predator, that he defends sexual predation. And of course, that he came out with a full-throated endorsement for an accused child molester. And she speaks out about him. And he does not like that too much. So he decided to tweet about her the other day. And he decided to accuse her, of being willing to do anything for money. So when I was, I've started listening to Sarah Huckabee Sanders whenever she gives her press conferences. I used to catch just the highlights of these if I took clips out of them. But I've started listening to them, and you don't have to do this. I do this, so you don't have to. I've started listening to her press conferences in their entirety. And I got to say, you of course have to be stupid to believe what she says. But if you're at all stupid, it's really, she's a really good liar. Now, if you can discern these things, like I can, then, you know, you don't have to worry about being taken in by her lies. But she's a really good liar. She's got a really good excuse for everything. But sometimes a degree, not a lot, but a degree of truth comes out. And I said, what is the White House going to say about this tweet? So she comes out, she gives her speech. You know, she says, we're going to talk about this, we're going to talk about that, make America great again, Nazis are awesome. And then she says, all right, I'll take questions. The very first question is about that tweet. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders launches into this.
The president said today that Senator Gillibrand would do anything for campaign contributions. Many, many people see this as a sexual innuendo. What is the president suggesting?
I think that the president is very obvious. This is the same sentiment that the president has expressed many times before when he has exposed the corruption of the entire political system. In fact, he's used similar terminology many times when talking about politicians of both parties, both men and women, and certainly in his campaign to drain the swamp. The system is clearly broken. It's clearly rigged for special interest. And this president is someone that can't be bought. And it's one of the reasons that he's president today.
So you're saying that this quote, Senator Gillibrand would do anything, is a reference to campaign contributions in Washington, the swamp. This has nothing to do with her being a female. What is he alleging would happen behind closed doors with her?
He's not alleging anything. He's talking about the way that our system functions as it is, that politicians repeatedly beg for money. That's not something new. And that comment, frankly, isn't something new. If you look back at past comments that this president has made, he's used that same terminology many times in reference to men. There's no way that this is sexist at all. This is simply talking about a system that we have that is broken, in which special interests control our government. And I don't think that there's probably many people that are more controlled by political contributions than the senator that the president referenced.
Sarah, a large part of what she's saying is correct. And this is the problem with our moneyed system. If stuff like this gets to come back on him. See, and Donald Trump, he's been on all sides of all issues over the years. For and against abortion, for and against tax cuts, for and against wars. He's been on all sides of every issue. And as such, he gave money to all kinds of politicians. That includes Kristen Gillibrand. From what I was able to dig up, he's given about $10,000 to her collectively. So over time, not in one big fell swoop, but $10,000. He gets to say that he gave her money and that she would do anything for it. So, although I don't think it's true, I don't think she had sex with this the big Cheeto president. What Sarah's talking about there, this moneyed system, this is the kind of trouble that it gets us into. So there's a slight degree of truth that money corrupts. And our politicians, instead of working, are begging all the time. Kirsten Gillibrand is one of those who went begging for money because of that system. And Donald Trump now gets to make the claim that he gave her money, she would do anything for it. But let's take the other part of this issue too. For a president, for a sitting president to take this particular tone, to say this, to accuse a sitting member of Congress, a woman no less, of being a whore for money. So I can't, first of all, I don't like that it's happening. And I can't say that I can't believe that it's happening because Christians, even deep white evangelical Christians brought us to this point. Now, it's not all of them. There's a fair amount of them that I'm certain are good people, but they're the minority. So the majority are these super gross ones that are willing to do anything that it takes to bring about the end times. And so we end up with stuff like this. We end up with a man like this who they're willing to defend no matter what. Hillary Clinton used a private server and they wanted her head on a pike. They still scream for her to go to prison. Donald Trump clearly broke the law during the election. And they're calling it not real. They're defending child molesters and they're defending Nazis. And for what? So that they can bring about the end times. And it's pretty insane. There's an editorial over at USA Today and it says, with his latest tweet clearly implying that a United States senator would trade sexual favors for campaign cash, President Trump has shown he is not fit for office. Rock bottom is no impediment for a president who can always find room for a new low. This isn't about the policy difference we have with all presidents or our disappointment in some of their decisions. Obama and Bush both failed in many ways. They broke promises, they told untruths, but the basic decency of each man was never in doubt. Donald Trump, the man, on the other hand, is uniquely awful. His sickening behavior is corrosive to the enterprise of a shared governance based on common values and the consent of the governed. It should surprise no one how low he went with Gillibrand when he was accused during the campaign of sexually harassing or molesting women in the past. Trump's response was to belittle the looks of his accusers. Last October, Trump suggested that he never ever groped Jessica Leeds on an airplane. Believe me, she would not be my first choice, he said, and I can tell you, Trump mocked another accuser. Former People reporter Natasha Stoyanov. Check out her Facebook. You'll understand. Other celebrities and politicians have denied accusations, but none has stooped so low as suggesting that accusers aren't attractive enough to be honored with his gropes. A president who'd all but call a senator a whore is unfit to clean toilets in Obama's presidential library or to shine George W. Bush's shoes.
Trump has nominated a former top pharmaceutical and government executive to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Nomination of Alex Azar is unusual because HHS secretaries tend to come from the ranks of elected officials, such as governors, leaders in academia and medicine, nominated by the department. Azar has spent most of the last 10 years with Eli Lilly, rising to president of a key U.S. affiliate before leaving in January to start his own consulting firm. He served in senior leadership positions in Health and Human Services during the George W. Bush administration.
So regulatory capture strikes again. And that's exactly what we're dealing with here. So this past week, I talked about in a show back in February about how Ajit Pai, who is a former lawyer with Verizon, and after this is all over, I can promise you he's going to go back to Verizon, where he will be receiving handy jibbers from all of the top executives at Verizon because he gave them what they wanted. This is why we don't bring people from the industries that are being regulated and put them in positions to regulate or deregulate those industries. I heard Mark Pocan talking a couple weeks ago, and he mentioned that he's gotten thousands of calls into his office about preserving net neutrality. Thousands of calls. And the host of the show asked him how many of those people are for net neutrality and how many are for getting rid of net neutrality. And he said it wasn't even close. Now, this is one congressman, so it's not scientific. 100% of the people that called his office. So we're for maintaining net neutrality. And then, of course, nationally, it's over 80% that want to maintain net neutrality and over 70% of Republicans that want to maintain net neutrality. So naturally, Ajit Pai decided to get rid of net neutrality. Republicans do not like criticism. Trump said right away, and I covered this in the show back in February, that we need to do something about the internet. The headline was, one of Trump's first moves is the end of an open internet. He does not like the free flow of information, especially when that free flow of information is against him. And in doing this and in getting rid of net neutrality, he's going to be able to stem the flow of some of that information. In places, in countries where they've gotten rid of net neutrality, we've already seen this. And Comcast is already currently working on fast and slow lanes for their internet. So is Verizon, which has a whole separate company that provides internet for rural users. And trust me, there will be fast and slow lanes. There will be packages. There will be gigantic companies who can pay more to get their traffic sped up. While me, as a small business, well, I'm not going to have the millions of dollars to pay to the ISPs to get my traffic sped up. So as soon as it happened, this came out from Fight for the Future. Quote, today the FCC is voted to gut net neutrality protections among widespread protests and overwhelming opposition from across the political spectrum. Ajit Pai's extreme proposal, it would hand gigantic telecom companies like Verizon and Comcast the power to control what we see and do online with new fees, throttling, and censorship. But that's not going to happen. The headline, Ajit Pai is going to lose. The organizations behind BattleForTheNet.com and Team Internet are announcing a massive internet-wide campaign to demand that our elected officials in Congress use a resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act. So here's the way it goes. The Congressional Review Act. This was something that was put in place by Republicans. And the idea for Republicans was that if one of these regulatory agencies, the FCC, the EPA, if one of them, one of their regulations is just seen as too extreme, as seen as too hand-binding, then the Congressional Review Act can review what that agency did and overturn it. The backlash to the FCC's attack on the internet has reached a boiling point. Now, every member of Congress will have to go on record and decide whether to stand up for the free and open internet or face the political consequences of awakening in its wrath during an election year. So remember, 2018 is an election year. If we bring up the, and there's legislation being drawn up by Democrats and only Democrats right now. They're the only ones not afraid of the free flow of information. There's legislation that's going to be introduced on the floor, if it's not being introduced on the floor right now, about this particular issue. And Republicans are going to have to vote for or against it. They're going to have to say exactly where they're at. And everybody knows what this issue is. A couple years ago, when we fought for it back in 2014, they did it. But everyone is pretty clear on what it is now. So a CRA only requires a simple majority in the House and Senate, increasingly within reach, given the unprecedented backlash and that Republican lawmakers are already receiving. The telecom industry spent millions spreading misinformation to pit internet users against each other and to turn net neutrality into a partisan issue. They have failed. Net neutrality has more public support now than ever before. Internet users are educated, outraged, and strategic, and they know that Congress has the power to overturn the FCC vote. Lawmakers cannot hide from their constituents on this issue. The internet has given ordinary people more power than ever before, and we're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that it goes that way. In recent months, there have been more than 1 million calls to Congress through battleforthenet.com and other online actions. So what's going to happen immediately? Well, likely nothing is going to happen immediately. This issue caught fire long before the vote was taken, and it's burning white hot right now. So it's very likely that Verizon and Comcast, the two companies that wanted this the most, the two companies that paid the most for this to happen, they're not going to do anything yet. They're just going to hope that this sort of simmers down, and then they can come back with their fast and slow lanes in a couple of years, touting them, of course, as helping you, the consumer. This is the help that you have been waiting for. But we're not going to forget about this. And this issue will be resolved over the next year. And I don't think the telecom companies, I think they're going to start putting infrastructure in place for the fast and slow lanes and for the packages and all this other stuff that they're planning on. It's hard to say what they're going, exactly what they're going to do. But I believe the fast and slow lane, that is going to be a thing, definitely, because there are already leaks coming out of Comcast that they are setting that up for their internet service. We have the most expensive internet in the developed world, and it's also the slowest. And the Republicans, along with Trump, would like to slow it down and make it even more expensive. And it's because of that whole free flow of information. Remember, Trump can't handle criticism, and Republicans do not like the free flow of information, especially accurate information. Think about the fake news term, how much that gets thrown around now. And it was coined to talk about all the Republican-leaning stories that were going around that were not true. But the fact that the president of the United States uses this term all the time has allowed other dictators around the world to use this term and to still be taken seriously as a leader. Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about this recently. Remember, she speaks for the president. She was asked about this recently at one of her press conferences.
Bashar al-Assad and Rodrigo Duterte both recently have used the phrase fake news to dismiss damaging reports about their regimes. And a state official in Myanmar recently said that the Muslim minority Rohingya don't exist and added it's fake news. Is the White House concerned at all about authoritarian regimes adopting this phrase, fake news, to try to delegitimize the press? And does President Trump bear any responsibility for the popularization of this phrase among some world leaders?
I think the White House is concerned about false and inaccurate information being pushed out and to mislead the American people. I think I made that clear yesterday. In terms of other leaders, I'd have to look at their comments to be more specific on what they've said. But our concern is making sure that the information that the people receive in this country is fair and accurate. And when it isn't, that it's corrected and corrected in the same fashion in which it was first presented when it was wrong, which is very rarely the case.
Okay, so that's a lie. That's a flat-out lie. Sarah, you're not even trying that time. That's a full-blown lie. But just the fact that other dictatorial world leaders are using our president's language. We're the bastion of freedom, using our president's language. It should give us all pause. So Chattanooga, and I talked about this a couple of years on the show, Chattanooga has a super fast publicly owned internet. They decided after the economic crash to take some of that recovery money, some of the stimulus money, and they decided to build this super fast internet. And it's been huge. It's super fast, it's super cheap, and it's publicly owned. And it's been great for Tennessee, for Chattanooga, Tennessee. And really everybody could do this. We should be doing this as a country. But because we've handed it over to these private companies, they haven't spent a lot of money improving it. They've simply taken this thing that was built by the government and used it to make as much money as humanly possible without really providing all that great a service. But what I pay for my internet and what I actually get for my internet, it's really not all that awesome. And I have Comcast, and they're raising the prices all the damn time. They're not giving me more. They're just raising the prices all the time. And I got rid of their equipment years ago. And as soon as I got rid of their equipment, yeah, it drops the price of my internet by $15. But within a few months, they find some excuse to raise my internet by $15 anyway. And of course, as I've mentioned in recent shows, as part of the provisions that the FCC is drawing up right now, they are trying to get rid of states' rights as far as this issue goes. My state of Washington has said that they will keep net neutrality in the state of Washington, but if the FCC gets their way, then it doesn't matter what the states say because they're going to have to follow what the FCC says. So that's another fight that we're going to have to watch out for in the upcoming years. So we have a president that demeans women, assaults women, talks badly about their looks, talks great about Nazis, talks great about child molesters. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is what it looks like when America is being respected again.
And as a country, we're being respected again. We're being respected again.
I know how stressful this net neutrality issue is. I've been screaming my guts out for a long time, calling the FCC, any and all the rest. And I know a lot of you have too. But history is on our side. The people are on our side, both Democratic and Republican. And if you want a bipartisan issue, this is a true bipartisan issue. I don't expect anything to happen in the short term, but considering the winds that are at progressives' backs right now with respect to the upcoming elections, we just need to keep our focus and we can overturn this in the next year. Yeah, they killed net neutrality now, but this fight is far, believe me, far, far from over.
Think to hear some people talk that those good people who live at the top of our economic pyramid are being taxed into rags and tatters. But what is the fact? The fact is that they are much further away from the poorhouse than they were in 1932. And you and I know that as a matter of personal observation.
So what's happening in the U.S. economy right now is actually happening to a fairly large degree all over the world, even when it comes to our Nazi problem. There's a rise of the far right in other countries. So the economic bubbles, and one of the ones I want to mention real quick is, of course, the Bitcoin bubble, which is now by far and away the largest bubble ever. Largest economic bubble ever. The Bitcoin thing alone could bring down the entire economy, not to mention all the stuff that the banks are doing and that hedge funds are doing. And, you know, that's being done with derivatives around the world again. Bitcoin, there's only 21 million pieces of Bitcoin in the whole world. That's it. That's all there is. And they're not making any more. And less than a year ago, it was valued around $1,000 per Bitcoin. And the last I checked, it's like 18,000 somewhere in there per Bitcoin. So even though Bitcoin is not real money is being put into it. And this is what happened with the housing crash and some of these other things that led to the 2008 economic collapse, is that, yeah, real money was at stake. You know, even though these were inflated values, real money was being put in. And then when the whole thing came out from underneath, you know, people lost their homes and any and all the rest, but real money, the real money that was put in, that stuff was lost too. After that whole thing happened, we of course had to give these banks a bailout. That bailout is still pretty fresh in people's history. And banks and hedge fund managers, they realized that. And so what we're looking at happening now is what's referred to as a bail-in. Rather than having the same kind of collapse, first there's going to be a bail-in. So I was listening to Professor Wolf talk earlier this week, and he mentioned this. Ah, the bail-in. Well, this is what it means.
A bailout is when the bank messes up, makes loans to folks who can't pay back, or otherwise misinvests the money that has been deposited or contributed to the bank. And when the bank falls apart because it can't honor its obligations, having made bad investments, it turns to the government to bail them out. The problem with that, and that's, of course, what happened back in 2008 on an incredible scale around the world, the anger of the public was, oh, my goodness, the government is using our tax money to bail out the failed economic activity of private profit-driven banks. There's something wrong with this picture. And so it became clear to bankers that they could not rely, in the event of future economic downturns, they could not rely on turning to the government as they did back in the 30s and as they did again in 2008. So they came up with a new idea to reconsider the deposits as though they were, in some sense, assets that the bank, as a private enterprise, could take. In other words, what they can now do, and this is true in many countries, including the United States, is under specific circumstances, the bank can access your deposits, consider them their assets, and therefore solve, hopefully temporarily, their failed economic activity by using your money and not having to go to the government to be bailed out.
So your money is backed up by the FDIC, and that's for the banks. And of course, if you're in a credit union, there's a whole separate thing similar to the FDIC that also covers credit unions. So your money is already backed up in the bank. And last time when all of these companies collapsed, they went to the government and said, give us money. And of course, they were given taxpayer money with little to no strings attached. And so realizing the PR nightmare that came with that, they said, what we're going to do this time, and this is, if you're in a credit union, you're very likely safe. But if you're in any sort of junk bonds or risky hedge funds or in a bank like Bank of America or Wells Fargo, and yes, I'm naming them by name, then your money is now considered to your bank to be an asset that will be used to bail them out. They may or may not still run to the government and ask for money when they collapse the economy, but the very first thing they're going to do is what is referred to as a bail-in. And of course, they won't get into any sort of trouble unless you go and try to clean out your bank account and you find out that the money is not there. And of course, if the money's not there, then it's very likely that they can just apply to the FDIC and say, hey, we screwed up, we took our depositors' money, and we spent it on ourselves. Could the government please bail us out? You know, and so they'll probably get bailed out even still. But to avoid that kind of a nightmare that comes with that kind of a bailout, they're already planning what is referred to as a bail-in. And if you belong to a bank, this is very likely what's going to happen to you during the next economic collapse. And this bill, and these banks, everybody's partying right now like it's 2008. We've got bubbles. The stock market is through the roof. You know, deposits and money's cheap and deposits are high and all. Everybody's partying like it's 2008. And of course, just like back then, we've got this gigantic tax cut coming down the lane. Because it's not just going to be enough to take your money that you have on deposit and that you have in your home and that you have in Bitcoin. They want other money too, because when it comes to getting your money, enough is never enough.
As a candidate, I promised we would pass a massive tax cut for the everyday working American families who are the backbone and the heartbeat of our country. Now we're just days away. I hope, you know what that means, right? From keeping that promise and delivering a truly amazing victory for American families. We want to give you, the American people, a giant tax cut for Christmas. And when I say giant, I mean giant.
And there are already people like me, and of course Bernie Sanders, and hopefully you, that are screaming our guts out about this right now. This vote will likely come up next week by the time you hear this show, depending on how quickly you listen to this show after it comes out. This bill might have already passed by then. They realize that there is a Democratic senator coming in and that they're ramming this thing through, and they don't even know what's in it, and they're not even reading it, and they don't care, and they're writing things in the margin, and they don't really care what you want. They're just going to pass the damn thing anyway. And some of us are trying to point out, and this will be the thing. If all these other factors do not come into play, this will be the thing that causes the full economic collapse. In 2008... compared to what's going to happen in 2018, is going to be considered a freaking bike ride.
Well, do you think it's a good idea to cut Medicaid by $1 trillion, cut Medicare, cut education, cut environmental protection in order to give $1.9 trillion in tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country? What percentage of the folks do you think would say, oh, yeah, that's a really
great
good
idea? I'm afraid we're making real low numbers.
I mean, you're looking at single digits.
Yeah,
okay.
There we are.
And yet, and here is the crisis of our time. Nobody believes that what the Republicans are talking about makes any sense at all. Every poll that we have seen, whether it was health care, whether it's taxes, overwhelming opposition. But there is a group of people, we've got to be honest about this, there is a group of people who think this is a tremendous idea. And those are a handful of billionaire families who in this election cycle will spend many hundreds of millions of dollars to elect the candidates who support this crap.
Let's boil the whole show down to this. Ladies and gentlemen, point number one, the world does not have to end. And we do not have to bring about the end of the world. That's the first point. Two, the fight for our future, our free and open internet. This fight is not over. Yeah, they repealed it. And it's pretty insane considering nobody wanted it. But it happened, and this is where we get to fight now. Gear up for that fight. Keep calling your senators. Keep calling your House members. Lay on them. Turn out for your elections next year and vote out anybody that is not representing you. No more of this crap where, well, it's all the other senators and House members, and my senator, my House member, they're awesome. Watch what they're doing, because they're very likely not awesome. Mine, Jamie Herrera Butler, is not awesome. And then, of course, the global economic collapse if this tax bill passes. And we've heard from Depression-era economists, this will be the thing that collapses the economy. And then when Democrats run in 2018, the Republicans will point the fingers at them and say, hey, I've seen this before. When Barack Obama came into office, I heard Republicans say the reason the economy collapsed was because they saw Obama coming in and they knew that he was going to ruin everything. So they collapsed the economy. Crap. And that's what's going to happen this year. They pass this tax bill. They collapse the economy. They're going to turn to the Democrats, who people are beginning to look at in a serious fashion now. And they're going to go, the reason the economy collapsed is not because of our very horrible tax bill. It's going to be because of them. Because you voted for the Democrats. Put us back in power. Or keep us in power. And we will take care of you. That's what you have to watch out for. 2018 is going to be a good one. I'm very excited for it. And I hope that the DNC keeps doing the good work that they're doing. We'll get into that more in later shows. But for now, just remember, the world doesn't have to end. We're going to get back our internet. And we still have time to fight the Republican tax bill. Go forth, my children. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fiery Camp. At our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Listen to us on the go, or like us at facebook.com/TFYCPO. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail is just a general statement. Okay, you can email us at TFYCPO@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I have woken you up, good morning.